My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's episode of Mysteries and Monsters. We've had some great feedback from our first episode on the Paranormal UK Radio Network, so thank you for all the kind words. Don't forget, you can find all our old episodes through Podbean by just searching for Mysteries and Monsters. We've covered Champ, the Beast of Boggy Creek, Poltergeist, UFOs, Mothman, Bigfoot and much more. So if you love cryptozoology and mysteries, you'll be sure to find something to interest you. Don't forget, you can subscribe to us on Podbean and YouTube by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. We're on Instagram at Mysteries Monsters, and you can find us on Twitter at Mystery Monsters. You can also follow us on Facebook to see some of the wonderful and weird stories we find, so just search through Facebook to find both of our pages under Mysteries and Monsters. You can also support us through Patreon. This week's episode is one that means quite a lot to me. It's an animal that I've just been fascinated with ever since the first time I saw some footage of it. So we're diving into one of the most well-known allegedly extinct animals in the history of the world, the thylacine. Anyone with any passing knowledge of cryptozoology will instantly know of the Tasmanian tiger. But the official stance from the Australian government is that these stunning creatures simply do not exist. They are officially extinct. Yet this flies in the face of thousands of witness encounters, films, photos and physical evidence that has been collected, including tracks, casts and scat samples. To this end, my guest today will change your mind about the existence of these marsupials, having had regular encounters on her property for over 30 years. Prepare to realise that the thylacine is very much alive and well across the Australian continent. In the arena of cryptozoology, one modern creature continues to be a totem for all of us that find this fascinating subject so intriguing, the thylacine. The grainy black and white footage taken from Hobart Zoo in 1936 gave us our last alleged footage of these beautiful and engaging creatures. Yet since the last official thylacine passed away, there have been thousands of sightings from Australia, and for many, the thylacine still exists. Today I'm joined by thylacine researcher Chella to discuss her research and her quest to find the thylacine. Chella, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Paul.
So, the thylacine, probably one of the most well-known alleged extinct modern creatures. What was it that drew you to this subject? Was it a creature that you'd grown up always being fascinated by, or was it a personal experience that kind of got you so into the subject?
Well, I've never heard of Tasmanian tigers or thylacines when I moved to South Gippsland in 1982. And there was a lot of bush there. We lived in the beach and they were there and you'd play with them. I didn't know what they were, which seems really funny.
I mean, the one thing I've found about this is that for many people who live in certain areas of Australia, they're absolutely convinced that the thylacine is still out there, still breeding, and there's a healthy population of them. At what point, Chella, did you realise that officially they don't exist?
I bought a computer in 2000 and sort of had a dig around to see what sort of creatures I was seeing and playing with and all this. And so it come up with the tiger bit and told me they were extinct and they don't exist and all of this. And I thought, oh, well, that's fun. I'm having hallucinations.
I mean, it must have been quite shocking to, when you finally looked at the research and what people were saying, that as far as you were concerned, you weren't seeing and interacting with what you were.
Well, they were there, and like I said, I had no idea what they were, but they've been there for many years. And as the old folk around here would say, what you see is what you see, and you don't tell.
I mean, is there a kind of, I'm trying to think of the right word, like a code in regards to looking after these creatures? Because, I mean, I've always been fascinated by the Thylacine ever since I saw that footage as a small boy, because they're such a stunningly unique creature. Even, in the pantheon of Australia's marsupial creatures, they are a very unique looking animal. What is it about the thylacine that you think creates such an excitement and a passion for Australians?
Well, it's if you're an Australian and somebody tells you something isn't, you go out of your way to prove that it is. You can't help yourself.
Do you think that's a standard behaviour for an Australian to basically prove it to the man that they're wrong?
Yes. You can't help yourself. It's just something that happens. But you'll find the people in the bush and the farmers and all that, they'll swear black's white that they're not there. They don't exist. Don't know what you're talking about. They've never seen them, but they'll defend them.
So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of people, and I mean, obviously we've had some notable alleged sightings over the last couple of years. I mean, it astounds me, for one thing, that everybody that ever sees one of these creatures or films them, I've seen, footage of creatures loping through fields, and because the gait is quite unique as well for the creature, because they don't tend to move what you would traditionally associate with a dog or a wolf-like creature. Do you is
No,
it
they.
oh, go on, sorry.
You want to know what they're image of?
Yeah.
They're a horse, a marsupial horse. They canter everywhere.
Yeah, because I've seen the footage, and it's a very unique style of moving, and like you say, it is very reminiscent of a horse. So, I mean, do you suspect that the authorities are basically working on a principle of ignorance is bliss, and if we ignore it, we don't have to defend it or protect it, or like you say, people will tell you they don't exist, but they're very protective of a creature that, as you say, for many doesn't exist. Do you find
That's
it
right. Go on.
Oh, go on. I was going to say, do you find it frustrating that the government have a basically zero tolerance to this subject? That it seems as though they're not interested in proving that they exist, yet there are thousands of people who have seen these creatures, Australians and tourists. There's been a couple of notable run-ins with tourists who've been out and about in the outback and the like. Do you think they've got a program of just basically ignoring it until it comes to the situation where they can't just deny it anymore?
Well, if somebody tells, publicises, oh, I saw this over there, and the next thing you know, it's baited with 1080, which is poison. Yeah, so I have never said where my sightings happen. All I'll say is South Gippsland, and that is an enormous place. couple of hundred miles this way and that way and the other way, and that's as far as I'll go with saying where anything is.
I think that's the worry as well, Shella, because unfortunately, I think we're both very aware that I think the other thing here is that similar to certain other creatures that aren't supposed to exist, I think any official confirmation that they are would see, idiots turn up just trying to bag one. Do you think that's got a lot to do with it?
Yeah, trophy hunters. I'll go out and I'll bag me a tiger and they carry on and I think you're nuts. So I don't know anything about them. It's very strange that. But people who see them, there is a network of us and we're all in cahoots with each other and we're able to track them. But who the other people are is never publicized.
So it's I mean, the one thing I've struck with my, looking as an outsider into this subject, Chella, I've been it, there does seem to be some kind of code of honor amongst thylacine researchers that there is nothing anybody can say, because there are so many people that have well-known sites. They know exactly what they're seeing, because a lot of these people are people that live in remote areas who know the animals in their area. They know what's out there, and for them, they're convinced absolutely there is nothing I or anybody else can say to tell them that they're not seeing and whatever. And to be honest, for me, I think there's been so many reports from around Australia and obviously also on Tasmania still, that I can't understand why it's still sort of dismissed.
Well, that's the way it is. Nobody really wants them to be about. They don't eat sheep. They don't eat cattle. They may eat chooks. I don't know, but I've never seen one do it. Mine live in sheep farms. And they're not eating the stock. They don't eat the goats. They don't eat anything except their marsupials. That's what they predate all the time. But, no, that's what they eat. They eat their other marsupials, and that's the end of the story.
I mean, obviously, we can. I mean, it's only, we're still, it's still within 100 years ago since officially passed on and became classed as extinct. But obviously, it's very well known the reasons for what happened. That, I mean, where did these stories of them attacking livestock come from? Do you think it was people blaming the thylacine for just rogue dog attacks, or basically wild dogs that had got out, or what? Because clearly, the reason for the thylacine's extinction was this whole theory that they were just destroying whole herds, which I think we can now conclusively say, looking back, simply wasn't going on. So where do you think all that came from, Cella?
Well, it's when they settled Tasmania or Van Diemen's Land or whatever you want to call it. Well, they were the English, of course. They'd come out and the conditions here were totally different from England, and there were convicts and there were sealers, there were wild dogs, there was everything killing that, and they needed, a scapegoat. And it was they when these tigers started appearing, they got the blame for and they got a couple of bounties put on them over the years, and thousands got destroyed.
I mean, I have seen some rather awful footage, pictures of so many thylacine corpses piled up on each other. I find it quite shocking, to be honest. Looking, I mean, it's I know it's you know I know it's one of those things, and you can kind of go around the world and look at, some of the mass huntings of certain animals that, just drove them either to the brink of extinction or to extinction. And it's such a sad situation, Chella. I think people don't understand the scope, because there was clearly a very large population 100, 150 years ago in Australia. I find the level of annihilation quite breathtaking, because, like I say, some of the pictures I've seen, you've got corpses piled on corpses. It's terrifying to see now.
Yes, well, people had to make a living in those days, and they could shoot a thylacine and skin it, sell its skin, sell it live. It was a means of survival for all the people. You can't blame them for what they did. They're not, all right, they did it, but they're not to, you can't hold them to blame. You did this and this and this. It was the times. So I don't look at that. Yeah, all right. You can say the Poms did it and all this, as we blame the Poms for everything, but it's just the way it is there. But no, they had to survive, and they were trappers, they were hunters, and that's what they were, and that's all they had to do. There was really no jobs or anything. They were the first people to, well, European type people to settle Tasmania. So it was the conditions at the time, and you do what you do to survive and to feed the family.
Yeah, very much so.
So I don't hold a grudge against them for that, but somebody had the foresight to offload a few hundred into Victoria and South Australia in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
So, yeah, I mean, this is the other thing as well, because I think people don't really, without it, once you dive into the thylacine, I think most people just basically have an idea that it looks a certain way. But obviously, looking at some of the research and stuff, the Australian thylacine and the Tasmanian thylacine are, there are differences, aren't there? Why do you think that? Because obviously, I think that, is it the Tasmanian one is a larger creature than its Australian count, its mainland counterpart?
Well, they're trying to say that they're both the same species and they're this, that, and the other thing, but your mainland ones are sort of miniature ones. Like the one, the Mundrabilla one, they've got all its measurements and it's only about 90 centimetres from nose to tail, and it's an adult female. They're very tiny and their back foot, from the toes to the heels, only 5 inches, which is how much is that? It's about 12 and a half centimetres. It is a very small animal and it has a different footprint and a different gait from the Tasmanian thylacine. This is what I have found. It's not written in any books or anything, but
So,
that's what I've found.
do you think they are two distinct species that come under the thylacine then, Chella? Do you think that they are related, but they are noticeably different enough to be classed as subspecies? They are related, but they're not the same.
Yes, they're related, but not the same. And I did once call it a subspecies, and it sort of got a bit carried away with that. But they are very similar in this. Some are striped. Now, not all thylacines are striped, and you'll have others say that if there's no stripes, it's not a thylacine. But if they've got their 8 front upper incisors and they've got their low back hocks, they are thylacines of some description.
I mean, it's one of those things, because we know across the animal kingdom there are certain animals that are very distinct. You only have to think of, obviously, the most comparable comparison is obviously a tiger. I mean, there are wild variations in their camouflage and striping, and you can, you look at it across the you know, across the animal kingdom. I mean, is a black and white horse not a horse then? You know what I mean? Because it just because its coloration is slightly different doesn't mean it's a different animal. So do you think that people just assume that they are all stripy, but they don't understand that there are such a variations in their coats?
That's right. They say, you know, no stripes, not a thylacine. But that's not right. There were no stripeless ones ever submitted for bounties because the people who captured them in their snares and traps and things didn't realise they were the same animal. So there are no skins of stripeless thylacines about. They didn't know what they were looking at. Yeah. That's all that boils down to.
Yeah, very, very probably, yeah. Which is incredible, really, because you would imagine that other than its coat, the animal would still be fairly recognisable.
Well, if you were looking for stripes, you get a beast without any and you really don't know what you're looking at, they wouldn't take a second look at it, just hit it on the head. And that was that.
So, as you referred to there, what was the main reason that they moved them from Tasmania onto the mainland? Was it that people were trying to do the right thing by basically relocating them rather than killing them? Or
yes.
And it was a case of just trying to get them out of the way because certain people understood what was going on.
That's right. There was quite a few people there who were into that. You don't find much written about it. I can't actually say who did what because I had a look at stuff that, you know, I was shown in confidence. So there were a lot of people wanted to. If you shove Tasmania up against Victoria, the bush is identical.
Yeah.
So popping them into Victoria wasn't a hardship on them because they had the same, like you've got your wallabies and your kangaroos and wombats and possums and all that to eat, the same as you got in Tasmania.
So in regards to the diet, as you refer to there, obviously, do they tend to sort of go after the wombats and wallabies? Because, I mean, it's one of those things I think people outside of Australia don't understand just how big kangaroos get down there. So do they tend to predate on the smaller marsupials or will they ever go at anything?
No, their preferred size is a young one around 2 years old. It's of course it's been out of the pouch. It's about shoulder height on its mother, and this is what they now. When you think it weighs probably 40 to 45 kilos, and a 40 to 45 kilo animal isn't going to bring down a 6 foot big old red roo weighing 100 kilos.
Yeah.
He can't do it because he has to grab him by the neck, give him a shake to break the neck to kill him. So they go for something, it would be around 10 to 12 kilos would be tops in one.
Yeah. So going back to when we started the conversation, Chella, when you bought your property, how long was it before you came into contact with the thylacine population down there? Was it something that took a few months to kind of till they kind of got used to you guys being there, or was it just basically they just carried on regardless of someone moving into the area?
Well, they're very curious about humans, and they're very standoffish to start with. And after I'd been there a couple of years and working in the bush and all that there, they'd just sit and watch you. You could touch them, you could pick them up. I mean, when you think about what I used to do and had no idea what they were, They're not ferocious animals. They're friendlier than a kangaroo and a wombat.
Yeah. I find that remarkable as well, because whilst it doesn't happen quite a lot, I'm sure anybody would immediately think of a comparable case in regards to some of the incidents with dingoes over the year. Would you say that they're far more a more placid creature than in comparison to a dingo? Because I appreciate that dingo attacks are not that common either. I think it's one of those things that tends to, when one happens, it tends to get blown out of all proportion, strangely enough. So, do you think that they are distinctly different to some of their Australian counterparts, the thylacines, in regards to the way that they are quite friendly and curious?
Yeah, well, your dingo isn't a marsupial, it's a placental animal.
Right.
What's the difference? So, I've never seen a thylacine or a dingo together because where we are, there are no dingoes. But we have had a dingo Kelpie cross dog. No, it's perfectly all right. But, no, I wouldn't know about a wild dingo. I've seen them around Ayers Rock and all that there, but
Yeah.
no close contact with them.
I mean, that's always I've found interesting, because correct me if I'm wrong. Weren't dingoes introduced about 4,000 years ago? Are they originally from the further out in the Pacific, or originally Chella?
I think from Southeast Asia,
Yeah.
Indonesia. Around there's something like the New Guinea singing dogs, and there's I can't think of the name of the one that's in Thailand, but they're sort of from around there.
Because it
They're
is.
sort of
Go on, Chella. Sorry, my love.
probably interbred with other dogs, with the sealers and the whalers and all that, because they were all over Australia and all the islands and that. For many, many years before the place was settled, and they had wild dogs and dingoes and you name it, they were there. So what bred with what, you don't know, but a dingo will never breed with a marsupial.
Yeah, very much so. So would you say, I mean, that was quite interesting, because obviously my experience, probably the most famous breed of dog from Australia is the Kelpie, because obviously they're known as very intelligent and determined dogs. Do you think that's another thing in regards to this kind of interaction that the thylacines have, that they don't tend to mix with? Like I say, for an outsider, I think people would be surprised to think that the thylacine and the dingo just don't interact in that way.
No, I think the dingo may have thought they were dinner or something. I don't know. Because they were on the mainland, they were smaller. So I'd say the Tasmanian variety these days is probably half a dingo higher than in height
Yeah.
and length. It's a big animal.
So, from those early interactions, I mean, obviously, you've been able to study these creatures at a close quarters, Chella. In regards to their lifestyle and how they bring up their young and everything, are they quite similar to other marsupials, or are they, a more sort of individualistic? Do they live in packs, or do they basically spread out as the pups grow older?
Well, they live in family groups. It takes from the time a joey is born, it takes 5 years for it to reach maturity. And they live with the family the whole time. The boys will wander off when they're around 4.5 to 5 years old. And they go in one direction. The girls will stay with the family until they meet a male, and then the male will stay with the female and her family for 12 to 18 months
Yeah.
when they get over the first breeding season.
Oh, that's interesting. Because usually in that kind of situation, if you have a male and a female that kind of start breeding, I find that quite interesting that the male comes to live with the in-laws essentially, doesn't he? So, I
Yeah.
mean, it do they then once they've done the breeding season, do they? I mean, are they quite, do they build a relationship where they stay together, as a, as a family unit, or do they kind of separate and the next breeding season they may pair up with different thylacines, or do they build a family unit and keep moving forwards?
It's a lifetime thing. When they mate, that's their mate for life. And they breed every 2 years because mum feeds the young ones for 18 months. They still have milk. You'll read in on stuff on the internet there that at 9 months they're totally independent of mum and they're this and they're that. And you're talking, you know how big a kelpie is, don't you?
Yes.
You think of something 5 inches shorter in the rump and probably another foot longer in the body. And this is a 8 to 10 month old Tasmanian thylacine. It's a baby. And they're babies until they're almost 4 years old. They spend the first 3 years of their life growing longer. Now, the ones who I've been with for the past 3 years, they're 2.5 years old now. They're about 4 feet from nose to tip of the tail, but they're only 16 inches high, which is what, third, under 40 centimetres. So that they still have to grow a fair bit longer, and then they'll, in about 12 months, they'll just start shooting up and they'll be around 3 feet at the shoulders in height. So they are a lot bigger than what was originally in Tasmania. And I'm only talking about the ones in South Gippsland because they're what I know most about. And 3 feet high at the shoulder and around 8 to 9 feet from the nose to the tip of the tail.
Blimey, that's a big old animal.
Oh, they're stunning.
I can imagine. I can absolutely imagine. I mean, this is the other thing as well. Obviously, you've referred to your experience of where you are in South Gippsland in regards to the thylacines, but they do seem to be quite well spread across. I'm thinking of sightings that have come from Victoria, Western Australia, South Australia. Do you think that they? But it, there don't seem to be that many reports of them being sort of in the northern areas and the northern territories and things like that, Cella. Do you think that they prefer the environment on the basically the south of the country, or do you think that they could possibly be everywhere, really?
Well, they have to be on the coast because when they have young, the parents go wading in the water and they bring their wet legs back and the babies suck the salt off them. They have to have salt in their first 2 years.
Wow. And have you seen them doing this in this kind of interaction where the parents will wade out and then the pups will suckle the legs to get their salt?
They do that. The babies don't go with the parents on hunts or anything. They are left.
So
And people seem to think they're left in a den, and you know, and the little animals stay. This is nothing. They're all around paddocks and everything with milk.
So they basically just have a little wander about while the parents are out of town, really.
Basically, yeah, well. At the moment, they came out of the pouch the third week in June. July, they've been learning how to walk. They come out of the pouch because they have to have supplementary feeding. And, you know, people make a big thing about these muscular stomachs they've got, and they reckon that they can gorge themselves in case they run out of food. They're not going to know there's no food tomorrow.
Yeah.
They do the gorging because they do regurgitation into the baby's mouths. So if you've got mum, dad, and a couple of older siblings, everybody eats up and feeds the babies. And they do this from when they get out of the pouch, and that's in June, and till September they fed 6 to 8 times a day with the regurgitated stuff as well as their milk, and they're still in the pouch. They only come out to be fed.
Yeah.
End of September, they're down to 2 meals a day. So around 6 in the morning, they're left, and they're picked up at 6 at night. And if somebody is exceptionally hungry and thirsty,
yeah,
I've got a recording of one having a tantrum. She went for 35 minutes and never stopped until Dad, you know, sort of go,
yeah.
And she shut up, and then she has to yap so they can find her, because where they left her and where I'd been, she'd been following me all around the place. It took them about half an hour to pick her up, but that's perfectly fine. And they took her home. Anyway, a couple of days later, she was out again. I mean, I have a terrible effect on them. And she in the paddock waiting for the parents to come home, and all the yapping and the oohs are going on, and mum come out, and I happened to pull up in the car at the same time, and I hopped out, and she looked at me, and she sat down, and she put her head back on her shoulders. Have you ever seen a bull sniff a cow?
Yes.
Yeah, well, this is what she did. She curled her top lip up, her head's right back, and you could see her sniffing. She looked at me a few times. She walked about another 60 feet, laid down and fed the baby. That's how scared she is of me. And I'm 50 metres away.
So how many pups do they tend to have when they breed?
Well, they have 4 teats. We probably think that, you know, there's more than 4 embryos that are born, and it's survival of the fittest to into the pouch. There's 4 teats there, and last year we had 1 set of twins and 5 singles.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that I was being with. But any of the others, I don't know what they had or how many survived. You know, they start off with 4, and so we've got I ended up with 23 animals that I was able to identify. And if I yahooed and carried on, they'd answer me and come and look at me.
So over this amazing length of period and these interactions that you've had and these relationships you've been able to build with these creatures, have you been able to gauge their average lifespan? I mean, how long, you know, when people think of animals, you know, you think of a domestic dog or a cat's usually, you know, between 10 to 15 years is usually the maximum. Have you had any chance to kind of gauge their life cycles at all, and how long an adult tends to live?
Around 15 to 16 years. And well, they only breed once every 2 years, so this is why their numbers aren't all that high. 8 years ago, we had no babies. None whatsoever anywhere. Something had happened. There'd been a lot of building going on, and everything suffered. And then the last couple of years, everything's just built up, and you have animals flying all around the place.
So do you think they're quite quite attuned to their environment then in that regard, Taylor, that incidental things, as you refer to there, can have a devastating effect in regards to not making them settle or to basically put them off breeding.
Well, they may have bred, and because there's a lot of development going on, and you know, well, kangaroos are expendable, you know, they're just useless old roos. But when you start doing that and getting rid of the bush, and then the roos are pushed further and further away, they've had to develop different hunting grounds. And it's not always successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredible, really, because I mean, I'm one of those people. I'm absolutely convinced that they're still out there. And then when I speak to someone like yourself, Chella, it just basically dots the I's and crosses the T's for me in regards to that, because I just find them such a wonderful creature, and some of the witness reports, these are very, very experienced outdoors people. They know exactly what they're seeing. I mean, I just find it crazy that people just aren't taken seriously. Or do you think that's a good thing that they're not?
It's a good thing. You don't want, you know, some people go to the extreme of saying, you know, I went to somewhere and I was on this street and two, you know, a mile down the road there, this happened. You'll get people charging down there with trail cams and cameras, and you don't tell people. You can say you saw them, but not where.
I think, and obviously, as you refer to, they're clearly very sensitive yet curious creatures.
Yes, but I've got a secret weapon why I can get so close to them. When I was four, I had polio, and that sort of wrecks a lot of things. I've always been able to get around, but I use crutches now, elbow crutches, and they find that fascinating. I'm not a threat. I'm not charging in and out of anything. I'm not doing anything to them. They know that they can come and lick me. I'll have salt on my hands. I carry sea salt with me, the crystals. Sprinkle that around a bit there. That doesn't hurt them. And yeah, the birds in the bush and all that there, they come and they land on your arms. So and huntsman spiders do the same, and they, ugh.
Well, the huntsman, I think, suffers from the fact that it's such a big spider, but in comparison, they are relatively harmless. They just look terrifying, don't
I just don't like them.
Well, having seen footage of them, and I've got two or three good friends of mine who have moved out to Australia. I've seen enough footage that I'm not particularly worried about spiders, but that's basically working on the UK version where, you know, anything bigger than a thumb's unusual. So I don't blame you, Cello, to be honest. It's not I whilst I'm not that concerned by them, I wouldn't like one crawling around on me.
No, I don't even like them looking at the house.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, throughout this period, was it? When did you realise that these animals were worthy of study and continuing to develop your knowledge, Chella, in regards to their whole life cycle and the way they behave? Was it something that you just basically you were so used to it, they basically became, you know, it's a pretty normal thing for them to sort of interact, and you were able to basically watch them grow up and develop as a family, or do you have to kind of go out there or and search for them, or is it essentially they're on your doorstep and that's just how it is?
Well, if I drive somewhere, they can hear the car, they know the engine noise, they'll come and find you if they want to have a play or anything. Or if they happen to be walking by, they'll say hello. But so then I thought, somebody said to me, you ought to get some footprints. And then other people say, yeah, you don't want footprints.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
And they reckon, you know, and then others say, oh, you don't need footprints. But then when I think about it, if there are no footprints, you're not going to go looking in that area for anything. So I started with the collecting the footprint business and whole track lines. And, you know, I do 40 or 50 casts to a track line. All ages, all sizes.
So, in regards to that, do they tend to use the same tracks? Do they basically know their ways and they have their certain routes that they will, go foraging or hunting in regards to that? Or are they quite curious and like to just wander off?
No, they have set routes, and if there's a dirt track or a sandy track, they'll use that in preference to the bush. And I like that because footprints are good.
Yeah, but it's clearly it's a lot easier to cast, find and cast them on a track. So that's yeah, definitely. So they seem very intelligent, Chella. From everything you're saying, it seems remarkable that these creatures are so switched on.
Yes, they're highly intelligent. They know what they're about, and if there are some people they won't show themselves to.
So they can be quite
And
particular.
but the neighbours will see them. Oh, yeah, they're particular. If they don't like something about them, or they may have, no one's ever shot at any of them there, but you know, sometimes they just don't like somebody. And they keep away. They walk past their driveway.
So
Yes, but they're.
do you think that's in regards to that they can kind of sense people's response to them? Because obviously there is always there's a saying over here, never trust a man that doesn't like dogs, or and people are very particular that if certain cats and dogs don't like particular people, there's kind of like a character associated to that type of person. Do you think they have a similar kind of response to certain types of people? They can basically tell who doesn't have their interests at heart.
Yes, if they don't like somebody, that's the end of it.
I mean, everything you're telling me, they just sound like a very friendly, curious animal that just sounds incredibly, fabulously intriguing. I'm absolutely blown away by the fact that you've been able to have such consistent interactions with these wonderful creatures over the last couple of decades. I mean, do you think you live in a particular hotspot, or have you heard, Chella, of anywhere where people have got a similar level of interaction with these creatures?
Yes. I just happened to land in the right place at the right time. That's all I can think of. But like I said, I never knew what a Tasmanian tiger was. We never heard about it ever at school. Yeah.
I mean,
You know.
I find that remarkable as well, Chella. Do you think, I mean, kids growing up, you're all aware of the natural fauna around you. Do you think that was a deliberate thing as well, to not discuss the thylacine, whilst you were at school? Do you think that was to do with what happened, or the fact that they just didn't want to acknowledge that these creatures may possibly still exist?
I have no idea, but you know, anything Australian, you weren't actually taught about. You were taught European history.
Which I find incredibly strange.
Well, it's very weird, but that's the way it was.
I mean,
Hey,
I mean, the one thing I've found about the thylacine is that, you know, everybody that I'm aware of in you know, who anybody to the outside would consider a major Australian cryptozoologist, be it, you know, people like Gary Opitt and Rex Gilroy. I mean, these guys are absolutely convinced that they're out there as well. Why do you think that people are very dismissive of, you know, very intelligent, learned people who categorically state that these creatures are still alive? Why do you think they're just so dismissed out of hand?
Because they're just people. They're not a brilliant scientist or anything like that. That's all it boils down to. You know, just a normal person walking the earth, you know, that they shouldn't be able to do this. That's something that the scientists have to do. I was told you need a university degree to be able to know what I'm doing in the bush. So basically, you're too dumb if you haven't gone to uni to know anything about anything.
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm aware, Chilla, a degree doesn't make your eyesight better.
No, but that's what I was told. You know, somebody says, oh, but so and so saw this and this and this. We have to believe them because they went to university. And if I said, I saw this and this, oh no, you wouldn't know what you were looking at. A mangy fox. I know what a fox is. I think I've got the best fox video on the internet, and people are trying to call it a thylacine. It isn't. It's a fox. I've even written it on the thing. It's called foxy
Mm.
But no. I know what a fox is, and people who live in the bush, they know what a mangy fox is. There's not many around. I don't know where all the mangy foxes come from.
Well, that's the thing as well, because, you know, so many people claim to have seen, you know, thylacines. I mean, obviously, I think we had a massive story at the beginning of the year. The guy that took one, I think it was just walking up a little mountain track near his ranch, I think, outside somewhere.
In Geelong.
And that was every time. That was a prime example of that. No, it's clearly a mangy fox. And I was just thinking, well, as you say, so we've either got to accept one of two things. Either these are thylacines, or Australia has a massive population of mangy foxes.
Yeah, we have mangy foxes, but you know, I've never seen one.
Mean, that's the other thing as well, because, I mean, obviously, foxes were another imported species, and in the UK, most people in the UK, unless you live, you know, in an area where you're quite fortunate to have an urban population, you know, places like London and Manchester and where I live in Sheffield. I mean, I've seen them frolicking out in the field. I grew up in the countryside, so I'd seen them as a kid growing up. But as an adult, you know, I would suggest most adults in the UK, unless they live in a major city, have never seen a fox. Yet, these foxes are supposed to be everywhere. I find that baffling, because that seems to us, you know, that works on the assumption, Cella, that foxes are very, you know, very easy to spot. Where in my experience, I think the opposite's true. They're very reclusive creatures.
Well, they usually come out in the night time, but I've managed to get a few videos of them in the daytime, and usually with something in their mouth as well. But I'm on good speaking terms with most of the foxes in the area until somebody shoots them, which I that doesn't bother me that they get shot. They need to be, and but as for a mangy fox, no, perfectly healthy, beautiful looking foxes. Yes, there's a horde of them about. But these experts, I don't think they've ever set foot in the bush, and they're telling you it's a mangy fox. All right, 99% of all these videos and that come up are foxes. No,
But I mean,
I think.
that's. Sorry, Charlie, go on, my love.
No, you go on.
I was going to say, I think that's also does you credit as well, because when you have things like this, it's very easy to kind of embrace any kind of footage and go, oh yeah, this is a thylacine, this is a thylacine. But I've noticed from several people who are absolutely convinced, you know, there is nothing anybody, you know, as far as you know, they exist. You've seen them, you interacted with them, you know they are there. The vast majority of these, you know, people who are convinced of the thylacine's existence will, you know, categorically tell you what a fox, you know, the difference are, and will usually dismiss, you know, the reports that get in the press by saying, oh, I'm sorry, but this is clearly a fox. I think that does it credit as well, because it would be very easy to not do that, Chella.
Yes. It's... I don't know what people think a fox looks like half the time. Our foxes come in a variety of colours. It's supposed to be a red fox, but they're grey and black and got various reds, you name it. That's what they're like. If I look at a fox, I know it's a fox. If I look at one of the tigers, I know it's a tiger. Because you check the back legs first. That's the first thing you look at. And they've got their low hock. Now, if an animal's got a high hock and they're calling it a thylacine, it isn't. They have a low hock. The miniature ones have the low hock. The Tasmanian ones have the low hock. And you can't mix that up with a fox. No way, no.
I mean, I've seen a couple of videos of what are purportedly films of thylacines, and the one thing that struck me about the two I've seen is that they clearly move in a specific way, as we've discussed. You know, you were saying that it resembles the canter of a horse. And the thing that always makes me laugh is that the naysayers always say, oh, well, that's clearly a fox with a limp. And you're like,
Yeah.
it's a what? So not only have we got a population of mangy foxes running around, they all seem to have, you know, arthritis by the sounds of it as well. So I sometimes think that the explanation is more ludicrous than the possibility that it's a thylacine.
Yeah, well, I'm quite convinced that these people, whether they're scientists, whether they've gone to uni or what, they've never actually seen a fox in the bush. That's all it boils down to. They know everything. It's like these people that go out and do track lines, ancient track lines. Now, the one that they got in Margaret River in Western Australia, they're calling it a thylacine track line. I want to know how they know that it's a thylacine track line when no one can tell you what a thylacine footprint looks like. You try and work that out. And now this is supposedly a mainland thylacine, and they're using that when people send things from Tasmania for footprints and gates and all this. They use that as the thing, you know, this is what it should look like. It's very weird.
I mean, has anybody kind of passed proof on to the authorities, Chella, and said, I want this DNA testing, I want this proving? Or is
You've
it,
got to apply for it.
you what, sorry, Chella?
You have to, if you want anything done, you pay for it, and you know that if you give somebody a scat and you've seen it come out of the animal, it will come back as a wombat or a dog. You can bet your life on one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I was talking to somebody the other week. We were on about big cats, and how there are mysterious populations of these creatures. In Australia is one of the prime examples where people are seeing cat, you know, big cats which just aren't supposed to be there. England's the same, and obviously you've got certain parts of the States, but obviously the States is more believable because they obviously have a cougar and cougar populations and the like. But I remembered watching a documentary series called Animal X, which was set and featured two Australians as I think one was a biologist and the other one was a cameraman. And they were in an area of Australia and they were looking for mystery big cats down there. And they'd been told a very similar story that what you've just said there, Chella, about it. It'll always come back as a wombat or a cat or a dog or a roo. So they deliberately got some, yeah, they deliberately got a piece of scat from a zoo, from a lion, and they sent that to the local authority to have it tested, and it came back as a dog. But they'd said they did it all on camera as well, so we knew exactly what was happening. I found that I think the thing about that is it was one of those where they'd got the biologist was quite skeptical, and when that re when the report came back from the authorities, it basically she was absolutely convinced instantly. She said that alone proves that there's something going on here.
Yes. You know, these big black cats that they're supposedly seeing, that is a 99% chance it is a marsupial. We have three marsupial carnivores roaming around South Gippsland. And, all right, one of them does look like a panther from the shoulders to the tip of its tail, that it'd probably be 8 feet long, but it has a big round face with nice long eyelashes. I had one sniff me and lick my shoes and everything, and I thought, I can't run away, I couldn't move. And I thought they would go up trees, so there was no point doing anything. But then it never hurt me.
I mean, what do you
Very
think?
strong.
In regards to that then, as far as you're concerned, they're there as well then.
They're there, yes. And the thylacoleos or thylacoleas, whatever you want to call them, they're there as well. The only thing that they resemble the ancient skeletons is the teeth. They've changed shape, as have the thylacines. They've grown a lot. But no, we've got three of these marsupial things, and they all seem to follow each other. So I did a map of you got your thylacine sightings all through Victoria, then the big black cats, and then these other sort of unidentified animals, and they all seem to follow each other, go up the middle part of the mountains in Victoria, and then down around the coast again. But
Go on, Chilla.
they're not harmful. They're not going to attack you unless you do something nasty to them. If you're just there, they're marsupials. A kangaroo won't attack you unless you do something nasty to it, and it will. But no, they're there. You just let them be.
I think that's
If they want to sniff you, they sniff you. If they want to sit there and look at you, they'll do it. And if you want to look at them, they'll let you. There.
Brilliant.
You
So,
know, people will tell you what, I'm as mad as a hatter.
well,
I don't care anymore.
and I all power to you, Chella, for sticking to your guns. It is one of those things. I just find it. I'm often taken aback with some of the insults that people like yourself do get. What do you think's next for the thylacine? Do you think they are events? Do you think we're going to get a situation where officially they're not going to be people aren't going to be able to ignore their existence anymore? Do you think something's going to happen that's going to prove that they're still out there officially?
Oh, well, I could do that right now. I've got videos and photos and stats and footprints, you name it, it's all there. But I'm not giving it to anybody because all they want is a body. And if you tell them, say you took them a live one, it would be dead within the end of the day. I don't know what I'll do with what I've got. It'll be for the family to decide when I kick off what they'll do. But I don't want them. You can't keep them in captivity because no one knows what they eat. All right, they eat wombats and kangaroos and wallabies and possum and all that sort of thing. But every 3 weeks, the mother's diet changes and she has to have something. Now they go through a stage, they eat the antichinases. You have to eat. And that goes on for 3 weeks. And then they'll go to another area and they'll go and eat something there. I don't know what they eat in every area they go, but it changes. And you can't put them in a zoo and feed them horse meat. They have to have blood. They have to have the lights, the lungs and kidneys and liver and all this. They have to have that. They can take a head off a kangaroo or a wallaby and get everything out of it through the hole in the neck, and there's not one drop of blood left. No blood on the ground, no nothing. And you'd swear somebody had taken the head off with a knife.
Just a clean cut, clean, very sharpened scissors, then, Cella.
Yeah, well, when you think about how skinny the necks are, this is why. So as they get their mouth around them. And we're not talking about a 6 foot old man roo. We're talking about a 2 year old roo, which would be shoulder height on its mother. Its mother would probably be around the 5 feet tall. They would be around 3 and a bit feet. That's as big as what the male can handle and kill and take away.
So, I mean,
When
the other
what I
aspect.
hear about
Oh, go
my
on.
cat,
Go on, Charlie.
when they're on the hunt, the roos generally live in family groups, 10 to 12 females and babies, right? When the tigers are about, they'll all flock together and, you lose count after you've counted 150 of them. And then mum will come from one corner of the paddock and dad will come up the middle of it and they'll set half of those animals flying out. Then the two of them get going and they split what's left in half and herd them over the fence into another paddock, and then they know which one they're going. And I've got some really good photos of all the females circling round the babies. I mean, it sounds awful, but this is what happens. And so mum will go flying through the middle of that. Dad will come flying at the back of her at right angles to her. Nab the baby, give it a shake, and they're off. And people will tell you in the old days, they used to follow them for hours and hours and hours. But that's not quite right. And they reckon that they can't run. Well, they can. We play games. They like to race the car. I sit on 39 Ks. And they can get in front of me and run across the road. And that's over a 5K trip.
So
So this is a game we play.
So they're capable. They are. So what we're saying here is we've got a, based on what you've witnessed in regards to their hunting, these are very intelligent animals that clearly have a communication level that allows them to be able to herd the roos until they can pick off the ones they want, as well as also being an extremely quick animal. I mean, these sound like very intelligent, clever creatures that it seems that you've been very privileged to be allowed to be, acceptable to them, I think, more than anything, Cella.
Yes, well, this is how crazy they are. We're talking about little beasties. They were, what, not quite 2 years old at the time. This is last August. I was collecting poo. And when I picked up a poo, I would leave a yum yum in its place. And so they watched me. I knew they were watching me. I was watching them watching me, and I'm picking up poo and putting little bits of yum, cat food actually, shoving that down in the ground. And then a couple of days later, I come back and there were four poos on top of each other. So I had to leave two piles of four bits of yum yums.
So we're basically leaving you an order.
But this is the game we play now. They leave a poo, and it's sort of a race between them and the rabbits who gets the yum yum. Now, rabbits eat grass, but they love yum yums. So you tell me they're stupid animals.
Big time.
They
I
know
mean,
that if they put it,
yeah, go on, Chella.
well, if they put a poo there, they know that this will happen, and sometimes I might leave a bowl of water and not to drink. This, you play in it, you jump in it, you do all sorts of things in it because they're still drinking milk and they're being regurgitated stuff. They don't need liquids. So the only time they really need it, if it's a stinking hot day. They may need a drink of water, but no, they've got me pegged. They know that if they do this or this or this, she's going to leave me one of them. All right, we might have to dig down a foot to find it, but it'll be there.
Brilliant.
Even their fathers get in on the act and play. I don't know who's stupider, them or me.
I wouldn't say either of you. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And I think you are very, very lucky, in my opinion, Chella, to be able to have witnessed and built these relationships with these fabulous creatures. I mean, what's next for you? I mean, are you continuing to build your research and your evidence, or do you think, as far as you're concerned, you've got everything you need and you're just happy to be part of this wonderful relationship?
So long as they let me hang around them. Now, at the moment, because the babies are, they're still babies, you keep your nose out of it, right? You don't go and, barge in on them and all this just because you think you might want to get a photo of them doing this, that, and the other thing. I don't do that. I can walk up and down the street past them or drive, which I usually do. That's acceptable. That's the way I like it because then it's them coming to me. So it's, yeah. No, I've got plenty of evidence there, but I'm not handing it over to anybody. All they want to know is location, location, location.
And at the end of the day, I
There
think,
are things I can't physically do. I've tried to go up a 200-foot cliff, but I have to get up there. Yeah, I'm obsessed with getting up there, but I can't. There's things like that that you need someone to do, but I was with, well, someone in South Australia. He'd come over here and we'd do this, that, and the other thing, but then he tried to run the show. He wanted things done his way. He wanted my research. He wanted this. He wanted that. And all that got hit on the head, so I don't trust anyone.
And I mean, to be fair, I mean, we're talking about, as we've briefly mentioned, all it needs essentially is, the wrong person to get involved, and we'd end up with another free for all. So, I think for us to have any hope of protecting what's left of these beautiful creatures, I think you do right, Chella.
Well, my grandson will be 21 in 6 weeks, so I'm no spring chicken. 60, how old? 66. And I've been at it for 30 odd years, so I've said to my daughter, I said, you'll decide what you're going to do. I said, but in my lifetime, I don't want to see them in a zoo. I don't want to see them captive. I said, I know they will be killed off eventually, but at the moment, they're having a wonderful life, and I'm content to leave it like that.
Fantastic. So
whether that's wrong or indifferent, I don't know, but I don't see telling anybody that, oh, if you go down here at 6 o'clock in the morning, you'll see this, that and the other thing. Nah, I won't do it. Look, I could have sold all this footage years ago.
Yep.
And have you ever seen it?
No.
No. And when you heard of the awareness group, that's who I was involved with.
Yep.
It would have turned into a circus, and I won't do it.
Yeah.
All right, he badmouthed me all over the place, but I couldn't give a hoot. I wasn't going to trade them for dollars.
No.
Very easy to do. I won't.
Yeah. No, you're right. No, I agree. It is. I mean, and I think that speaks volumes about your character, Chella, that you're not prepared to put these creatures in that position and, you know, as you say, end up seeing them sent into the zoos or stuck on a lab table getting dissected. And I think that says all we need to really say about the, you know, your relationship and the respect you have for these creatures.
I won't even give them a dead body.
Yeah.
If I come across anything, I will bury it. I get told that's the wrong thing to do, and I thought, in my mind, it's the right thing to do.
Well, clearly, I think you know best, you know, really, Chella, if you've had these relationships for over 30 years, I think you know what's best for everybody, don't you?
Well, you I don't want them locked up because that will kill them.
Yeah.
They have to be free. They range about 150 kilometres.
Mm.
They have to have that distance. They have to have their beach. They have to have caves. They have to have rocky business and all this so they can get up.
Yeah.
You know why they're so long and skinny is to weave their way through all the rocks.
Yeah.
That's their natural habitat. But that's, you know, all going away. But no, there's no way I'll be telling anybody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been blown away having a chat with you today, Chella. It's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, like I said to you at the very beginning of our chat, I'm thoroughly engrossed in these beautiful creatures. I think, you know, ever since I saw that footage, I just think they're such wonderfully unique, beautiful creatures. And I'm always delighted when I hear of new reports and whatever. So for anybody, I mean, do you work with any is there any organisations people can find online to keep up to date with the latest news or anything you're doing in particular? Or
only my page, Shayla Tanoi Thylacine Research and Victorian Thylacines in South Gippsland. I've got two pages.
Excellent. I'll put those in the show notes so with links so if everybody can find them. And all that's left to say is thank you so much for such a wonderful and rather charming conversation. It's been delightful to hear just how close you've got with these wonderful animals and long may it continue, Chella.
Yes, well, I'm quite content to let them live how they're living and leave them. And like I said, I may publish a book on footprint identification, which is it's non-invasive.
Mm.
You know, it's won't be photographs of them or any. All right, I've got a hoard of photos and all that of them. I'll tell you something if you don't print it anywhere.
Mm.
But one spectacular guy does not have stripes. He has circles.
Wow.
It's totally unbelievable. It's the gene pool.
Yeah.
But they're healthy.
Yeah. That's
You know, we're
incredible.
sitting there looking at it, and I'm thinking, oh my God, look at that. And he's as friendly as they come.
Goodness
So,
me.
yeah,
Well,
kind of, I really enjoy my hallucinations, but.
you seem to be quite well balanced, Chella, considering this. So, listen, I just want to say thank you once again for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I've been keeping up with what's going on, so I will continue to keep an eye on your pages and hopefully see some more bits and bats come up. And I just wanted to say thanks for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, well, you can see the heads of two of the females on there, and the profile picture of the Shayla one is the back end of one of them.
Oh, fantastic.
That's as cheeky as I'll get with putting anything up about them.
Oh. Well, listen, it's remarkable, and it's been wonderful to talk to you about this today. So, listen, I'll let you get back to enjoying the rest of your evening, and hopefully we'll speak again at some point in the future. Thanks for joining me today, Chella.
Okay, Paul. See you. Bye.
Bye.